Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey everybody, welcome to Movie Crush and Friendly Fire. That's right, it is the annual crossover edition of your favorite little show here and Friendly Fire, which is one of my favorite movie podcasts, co-hosted by my pals Ben Harrison, Adam Pranica, and John Roderick. It's a great show, everyone, and I enjoy sitting down and talking to these guys about war movies every year. We did Platoon last year. If you haven't listened to that one, go check it out. We did another Cabin Sesh. Different cabin this time. It's going to sound like Adam's episode did quite a few weeks ago. But, you know, I think we might just leave everything in there. I think there's some weed whackers at times, and I think a housekeeper comes by. So we may just leave it all in there as window dressing. So we got together on the old text thread, started talking about what movie to watch, and Ben suggested Tropic Thunder as a war movie. And Adam agreed, and I thought they were kidding. And I said, can we do a real war movie? And it turns out they were serious. I guess they consider Tropic Thunder a real war movie, and maybe it is, for all I know. It's been a while since I've seen it. I guess it was war stuff in there. But a real war movie, everyone, is The Great Escape. Can we all agree on that? So that's what we went with, kind of one of the all-time classics. A really good movie. I've seen it a bunch of times over the years, and had a little bit of a different take on this viewing than I normally do. As did John Roderick. So check it out. Here are my pals, Ben Harrison, Adam Pranica, and John Roderick of Friendly Fire on The Great Escape.
Hello and welcome to Friendly Fire, the war movie podcast that has put all its rotten eggs in one basket. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm John Roderick.
And I'm Chuck Bryant.
Hey, it's our annual tradition of doing a crossover episode with Movie Crush, the great podcast hosted by Chuck.
Hi, Chuck.
Hi, Chuck, you're the rottenest egg in this basket.
I was waiting to introduce myself and for one of you to go, your papers, please.
Papers, bitte.
Good luck.
Good luck.
So how's the sound? Good?
I hope so. Leaf blowers? Yeah, I mean, it looks good on the little posted stamp size screen on our recording device.
Great.
This is a movie that I had seen a bunch of times as a kid, but you said you'd never seen it before, right, Adam?
First timer.
Wow.
Yeah.
Does it hold up? Does it seem like a good movie to you?
I mean, that's the review portion of the show.
Did you just jump into the end. Yeah. We don't have a lot of time here. I mean,
does it hold up considering you've never seen it before?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, you watch.
Compared to
like,
the first time I never saw it, the second time was much better.
There are lots of movies that, like, if you see them as a kid, are very meaningful to you. And if you are introduced them to them as an adult, I've never seen Goonies, but I've heard that, like, it's not worth trying to get into it in your 30s. Because
I want
to
spend an entire show interrogating your non-seeing of Goonies.
Interrogating drink.
I never saw Goonies either.
Ooh.
What?
It was too late.
Can
for
we do
me
a special episode
new
that's just Goonies yeah with these two?
That's a bit of a war movie.
Wow.
Suddenly, your definition of a war movie has loosened up.
Well, you guys wanted to do fucking Tropic Thunder.
Chuck was being a real snob about what we picked for this episode.
Let's do a real war movie.
This is really a jailbreak movie more than anything.
It really is.
And I was struck by the like leitmotif and the theme song being really, really similar to the one in Bridge on the River Kwai.
Yeah.
The little like whistling theme that they come back to over and over again.
So much so that at the end of our River Kwai episode, I whistled the wrong song, and it was this song that I was whistling.
Wow, how did you know to do that?
He
just,
I don't know.
He when he was a kid, he had an album of all the great jailbreak World War II movie themes by Elmer Bernstein.
Yeah,
also an album of nothing but whistling songs.
I wonder why that is. Like, was there like in the 60s where they're like, yeah, this is the kind of music you have to have in a prison, like a war prison jailbreak movie.
Yeah, kind of jaunty. Because although this movie isn't very, I was about to say you don't want to bring anyone down, but
There's not a lot in this movie to. Here we go again, guys.
Nothing today. Nothing today. Thank you.
Thank you. That happened last year too, remember?
Yeah, the housekeeping just came by.
At the Academy Awards in 63, was this one of the best songs? Like they just had a whistler out there on stage?
I don't know. There is no whistling, though. And you guys keep saying whistling.
It's fife. It's fife music.
Yeah.
But this was the heyday of the great movie score, the score that would define, you know, with super catchy music that...
Right.
And this score is kind of insane. Because it beeps along for a little bit in the fife, and then all of a sudden it gets really dark and serious, and then it pops back up into a different kind of second theme.
With a three-hour movie, you can really like dig into a lot of different emotional territories and then like recover from them and go somewhere else. And this movie really does that. Like it has moments of like beauty and joy and moments of like real darkness.
Does it read to you as a comedy? Adam, seeing it for the first time, did it feel comedic?
It didn't veer all the way into comedy, but it definitely got out of the lane of serious war movie POW piece.
There's a little Hogan's Heroes-y feel to parts of it, for sure, where like you never feel like in the camp that they are truly like threatened. And I'm always amazed, it's sort of like with Hogan's Heroes too, with these camps that they're just allowed, you know, from the moment this film opens, they're planning their escape. Yeah. And they have a big meeting in the big meeting room.
And there's so much tradecraft to that. It's so awesome. Like,
oh, yeah.
Everything they try is like, oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
And then
they're really supportive
of
each other in a way that I found surprising.
Although Edinburgh was a bit of a dick at times.
Yeah.
That was his job. My God, he was the big X.
That's true. The big X.
Has can't mess around.
He said, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Stalag 17.
Oh, God.
But that, you know, the premise of those Luftwaffe prison camps was that they treated the prisoners really well because of this whole, like, aristocratic, to the manor born quality that the Air Force had still.
Is it airmen, jail airmen, and army jails army? Is that how it works?
That was the idea, yeah.
Navy sends Navy to Davy Jones Locker.
Yeah. The premise was, right, that the Luftwaffe was hosting the enemy combatants, their air peers.
They have a much better working relationship with their jailers in this movie than they did in Bridge on the River Kwai.
I don't think you see them saluting each other.
It's
right. But they straight up say in that first meeting between the big, who kind of looks like you, Ben, weirdly. Did you guys pick up on that? The head
the
of,
main Nazi?
Yeah. No.
Every bad Nazi looks like Ben a little bit.
Yeah, I noticed that.
The British guy. Yeah, I do look British.
They have that, I don't know, if I would have said you were French, you'd have a hard on right now.
Mm-hmm.
They have that first meeting where he's basically like, you know, we're going to try and escape. Like, what, do you expect us to not do that? That is our sworn duty as officers. And the German guy's kind of like, yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
They make the case that it's their sworn duty because it will like tie up resources and material that the Germans would otherwise be inflicting on the front. And I don't really feel like they pay that off in the actual jailbreak scenes. Like there's like Steve McQueen for sure does his part.
Sure.
Like he is lifting his weight in terms of like drawing troops.
Like 100 guys at least.
Yeah. And trucks and stuff. But everybody else is just getting nabbed by the Gestapo, right?
Well, what's interesting about the geography of this movie is that the Stalag Luft 3 or whatever, wherever they actually were, was in Silesia. Like it was in Poland, and they...
Why don't you look at Adam?
Because Adam is the resident Polish authority. It's in Poland, right, Adam?
It is, yeah.
They said Germany in the movie, though.
Well, because it was in...
Oh, but occupied Poland,
well, in,
subsumed into the German nation.
No, kind of the opposite. It was Prussia that became, that after the war, turned into Poland. But traditional Prussian territory. But way, way east. So in that early scene where we see the Russian guys with the fur hats going out to chop wood,
right,
which is weird because we never see them again, and it seemed like at that moment they sort of lived in the camp or something. I never understand why those guys were there.
And, well, is it like a fresh built camp? And my theory was that they were like the people that built it, and now they're leaving.
Nice.
They were just finishing up the punch list.
Yeah. Nice.
Well, so those guys, you know, if taking place in Poland, like they were sort of a natural, maybe not locals, but it wasn't that far. Anyway, so in the course of these guys escaping, we see them make it to Paris. We see them make it to Switzerland, make it to the Baltic Sea.
Coburn's going to Spain.
So for these guys to have to like spread all across Europe like that, and then we see them one by one get nabbed, it would have meant that that cops were on the lookout for them. Troops were chasing them kind of throughout Germany, and that's that would expend some resources.
The camp didn't read as Polish to me because the barbed wire fence wasn't inside the barracks. Mm-hmm.
You wanted to get there first.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I'm going to take that one, and now you don't get any.
But your guy was the coolest, one of the coolest guys in the movie, the Polish guy.
Chuck Brunson.
Man, how handsome is he at that age?
Beautiful.
And how fucking handsome is James Garner, man?
Yeah.
I mean, I just saw him, and he's like 35, 36. I'm like, he looks like fucking George Clooney.
Yeah.
Everybody in this movie, the actors are at least 30. I think Steve McQueen was probably 33. Garner was 35.
Yeah.
Bronson was like 42 already by this
he
point.
He was 42. Good Lord.
And jacked. Like a jacked 42.
For sure.
Oh, yeah.
I have a very distinct memory of watching this movie when I was a kid and my mom leaning over when Charles Bronson was on screen all sweaty and muscly going, he was kind of the Arnold Schwarzenegger of my childhood.
Wow.
Except 5'4".
Yeah.
Right? Sure.
But yeah, I mean, at one point, Steve McQueen says that he's like just got out of college or is in college. There's a lot of age fudging.
Yeah.
Because these guys, probably most of them would have been about 23, 24.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Well, maybe he got held back.
Right. He took all those summers off racing motorcycles and took him a little bit longer.
There was a moment when this movie didn't have much Steve McQueen in it, from what I read, and McQueen fought the director for more him. And McQueen's a guy who was taking a limo to and from the set every day. Like, he had a lot of power at this time in his career.
You remember there's a famous story about him making a movie with Yul Brynner, and every time he was in the background of a scene, he was always futzing with his gun. It was like a Western.
Yeah.
He was always loading his gun or famously with a cigar or something.
And eating an orange with the peel still on.
To the extent that Yul Brynner complained, like, this guy's trying to steal every scene he's in.
Right.
Because your eye would be drawn to the background. What the fuck is Steve McQueen doing? So he knew what he was doing.
I love how early on in the film, though, when they're there and they're immediately checking out how to get out.
Yeah.
And that one guy just jumps in the fucking Christmas tree truck. It's so lo-fi.
Boy.
He's like, all right, I've been here for 3.5 minutes. I'm gonna get out of here, guys.
Low-key, one of the scariest stunts in movie history is the guy stabbing the heap of Christmas trees with a giant pitchfork, and then a guy that's like 6 inches behind where he's stabbed going like, I'm gonna get out.
Yeah, you know, the safety back then wasn't exactly, they were like, where is he? Oh, I don't know, just stab low.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, like, those opening moments have a ton of comedy. Like, I love the smash cut when, like, Steve McQueen and the mole are describing their escape plan of pushing the dirt behind them by tunneling 3 feet under the wall. They're like going over this plan, and they're like, that's so stupid, it just might work. And then smash cut to them going into the cooler, just caked in mud.
Yeah.
Like, what a great moment.
McQueen's definitely the comic relief of this film, weirdly. Yeah.
Right. They're in the wow scene.
Yeah, yeah.
The Americans, right? I mean, he stands in for all Americans there. So he's got to have that swagger.
Yeah. Good point. How many Americans? There's the three, Garner. Well, I guess the three guys that do the Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Yeah, Garner, McQueen, and the guy whose job it is to throw McQueen's baseball glove back at him every time he gets recaptured.
That motif, who he clearly doesn't throw.
That was
the baseball.
A real Mean Joe Green moment right there.
Hey, kid.
Yeah.
That was a little before your time, Adam. Nice.
No, I was right.
I'm a collector of pop culture trivia.
Well, that scene was crazy to me because for Steve McQueen to leave his baseball glove behind suggests that he doesn't think he's going to make it. Because that is a great glove. Yeah. He's had it his whole life.
I read that was an anachronistic glove. It didn't. They didn't look like that during the war years. Apparently.
Is that your moment of pedantry or just a warm up?
That is a moment of pedantry, but
feels like it might have been his grandfather's glove.
Don't put the little sound effect on that, Rob. That's not the official one.
I was hoping that everyone would come in here with.
I could actually do my moment of pedantry right now. It wouldn't be terrible.
Well, let's hear it.
So at the conclusion of the March of 76, the Americans present to the British with invitations to join for a celebratory drink. Oh, I should preface this because we have Movie Crush listeners. Right. We always do like a moment of pedantry, which is something that I found in the IMDb goof section about the film. That somebody took exception to, and I try to find like the most pedantic one I can find usually.
That doesn't have to do with epaulettes.
Yeah. So this is the 4th of July set piece, and the Americans present invitations for a celebratory drink. At the door to the hut, Goff declares, "Down with the British," to which Roger and Mac enthusiastically reply, "Hear, hear," and "Quite right too." Goff's error was saying British, when the correct usage would be the English. In this context, the appeal of an inebriated Goff to a bemused Roger, based on South African Roger Bushell the Scottish MacDonald, would be sufficient to excite a moment of humor between the three historical enemies of England.
Oh, wow. That's
so
a good one.
This pedant well took exception to the construction of a joke that a drunk guy made.
Well done, though. I mean, he's right, right?
He's not right, I don't think. I think he's wrong, because we can assume it's a he. But
I just like the phrase, the excitement of humor. That's great.
I have done the math on how jokes work.
Surely you have been at the pointed end of the British, not English, it's English, not British internet pedant stick.
That was before I started muting everyone on Twitter.
Yeah. I had to mute a guy today that called me a ding-dong. Whoa. Because John Roderick calls me a ding-dong all the time, and now people on the internet think it's fine to call me a ding-dong.
You just muted him just because he called you a ding-dong? Yeah. It was a ding-dong of affection.
I've taken an extremely liberal approach to my use of the mute function.
Well done, boys.
Yeah.
Not even ding-a-ling?
Didn't even use ding-a-ling, which is slightly less bad, I guess. I don't know.
How great does this Panavision look, though?
It's spectacular.
Yeah.
It's also just a great transfer to HD.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful movie. I don't think I'd ever seen it in high def, but it looks
well, it really shines. You know, in the camp, you can only do so much, but it really shines once they get out of there.
Yeah.
And you get, like, those flying shots.
The territorial stuff is great.
Really gorgeous.
Those sequences really struck me because I wasn't conscious of feeling, like, closed in and confined in the first 2 hours of the movie. But that's kind of like the mark between 2 and 3 hours when they all get out. And it is, like, suddenly, like, the tone of the music changes and you feel, like free, and there are these like long meditative moments where like the two tunnel kings are like in a rowboat and they just hold the shot for 20 seconds while they row across some beautiful Bavarian river, and you're just like, wow.
Which was a great, like, as it turns out, plan.
Yeah.
There's no one out there.
They were,
I kept wanting Attenborough and the other guy to hide, just like go hide somewhere for a few days.
Yeah.
Quit just walking around cities.
Yeah,
you've got a very noticeable birthmark on your face.
Yeah,
just
that too.
Lay low, man.
Even the worst police sketch artist would be able to like make something that looked a little bit like
him. Yeah. He's got this here.
Yeah.
What do you think about the Attenborough hat tilt? One of the better hat tilts.
It's a great hat tilt. It's a great hat. I feel like it might
spared no expense.
It might have been a little jaunty. For Nazi Germany. You know, they had a lot of uniform jauntiness. The Nazis did. In the sort of black.
So they're not all bad.
No.
Not everything about them is bad.
But yeah, it's sort of the black trench coat era of German civilians. And that hat looks a little bit like New York, Broadway, 1939.
Right.
I wondered about it.
Yeah. Well, he also tilts his fedora once he gets out. So that's his move for sure.
Yeah.
He's the only hat tilter on the side of the Allies.
Well, except if you zoom back or if you rewind to the first 2 hours of the film, his Royal Air Force service cap is also tilted at a jaunty angle throughout the film.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He's really like, is that what you were referring to in the first place?
Sure.
Oh, I thought you were talking about his civilian hat.
Oh, no, both.
Yeah, he's got hat tilt going the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's his move.
So the civilian clothes are all made out of uniforms that they, like, put boot black on and stuff?
A little bit of suspension of disbelief going with how much just raw material they needed.
I love the, like, level of sophistication they bring to the jailbreak, though. It's, like, it's totally unbelievable. And it's,
yeah,
and it's a real story, right? Like, they, like, this actually kind of happened, right?
It is, but this is way fictionalized.
It's a real story, and I think the moment of pedantry that was true at the time was that what got left out was how many German civilians actually helped, including guards, helped them in their escape. So a lot of those documents that they actually used weren't forgeries. They were just brought in by German civilians and clothes and tools and maps and all that stuff.
It really felt like the ferret would become a composite character for that type of person, but they never position the ferret that way.
Yeah, and I think kind of a useful idiot.
Yeah.
Some of it was that the Luftwaffe, just like the German Navy, was not full of Nazis. So there were a lot of people, because they were these sort of upper class.
Yeah, Luger is definitely like disgusted by what happened to the 50 that get murdered.
One's Luger? Is he?
He's the commandant of the camp, and he gets replaced at the end by...
Yeah.
Well, he's super contemptuous of the high Hitler, Heil Hitler. Like, you can see from the very beginning, he thinks of himself as
just
a...
not as Hitler-y as you guys. I don't want to say Heil anything.
All right, Heil Hitler.
Now, was that true to how it could have been?
Absolutely.
And what about, what I also wondered about was...
Not to both sides it. Fuck. I'm against the Germans in World War II, but there were a lot that weren't
Nazis.
This
is a great movie if you were against the Germans in World War II, because you get to see a lot of them get kicked in the teeth and stuff.
But what about the notion that the prisoners had things that the guards wouldn't have?
Like Red Cross packages.
Chocolate and coffee and...
They could get mail from home.
Interesting. But and they didn't just take that and be like, I'll be taking this coffee.
No, because of the Geneva Convention and the Red Cross. I mean, there were all these rules.
What they didn't have was their own luggage and their own personal items. That was greatly exaggerated in this film.
That they would have baseball mitts and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense, I guess. But that's the whole notion with the ferret was...
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of... That
he could be bribed
scene
with cigarettes and chocolate.
Jimmy Garner basically molesting him. Trying to shove chocolate down his pants.
What an awesome come up for those Russian woodcutters at the beginning, where they get a bunch of cigarettes for like their axe and their hat and their coat, and then they get the axe, hat, and coat back immediately.
Yeah, that did not.
Hey,
take
free
very
cigarette,
long.
Cool. I mean, like, there's a ton of sophistication on the Ally side, but also there's a ton of sophistication on the German side in terms of like nabbing these guys and like catching the escapes. Like, the case is made that this is like an elite unit of prison guards, right?
Right, right. These are the best of the Luftwaffe's best. Although I think all the guards and all the people that would have been in the Luftwaffe and working at this prison camp would have been stationed here because they didn't have flight status.
Is this a plum gig? Like, because the ferret's constant fear is getting sent to the Russian front.
Right.
And I was like, yeah, this seems way better than that.
Well, the commandant says, like, let's just wait out the war here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty...
Like, all of us.
Yeah, that's a pretty tempting offer. Like, oh, right, just wait out the war. No. We're going to escape and make your life hell and get shot in the end.
Yeah. You're going to get fired. And probably killed.
But the weird thing about that in a war full of atrocity, murders, millions getting murdered, there were these little pockets of just like tally-ho.
Mm-hmm.
This is good sport.
Yeah, it suggests a fraternity of airmen.
Yeah.
And like a higher class of respect.
And you see it in war movies where the ship will get sunk by the sub and the captain will be welcomed in and, you know, given a cup of coffee, like all these rules of engagement that that make war seem fun.
I mean, this definitely had that feel of it's one of the least threatening World War II prison camp films.
And fairly nonviolent in its depiction of death. I mean, when the prisoners are marched out of the truck and shot with the machine gun, you only see the machine gun.
Yeah.
For example. And like, I think the most disturbing depiction of someone dying was the Donald Pleasance character and the blood that went all over James Garner's face. Like, it's a very, for as much implied violence as there is, as there is in the film, there isn't a lot of like disturbing, bloody death.
And no attempt was made to make that blood look like blood either. It looks like pomegranates.
Yeah, it looks like Garner was eating a delicious cherry pie out in that field.
Boy, you knew Donald Pleasance was going to be a problem from the very beginning when he walks in and talks about being a bird watcher. You're just like, oh boy, this guy's...
He's great in this movie. Apparently was familiar with him through the Halloween films. I'd never seen him play a role like this before.
Yeah. Apparently he played Himmler in the sequel to this movie. He switched sides in the sequel.
The Greater Escape?
It's like, I think it's literally called The Great Escape 2.
Wow.
Yeah. He was the president of the United States in Escape from New York.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
Yeah. But weirdly, Donald Pleasance was actually in the Royal Air Force, shot down over Germany, and imprisoned in a wartime prison camp.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And there's a story while they were filming this movie where he started to kind of offer some suggestions to the director, like, you know, it'd be good if the lamp hung like so. And the director was like, thanks, kid. Stay in school. And chased him out. And then somebody was like, you know, old boy, he actually was in the camps. And then all of a sudden he was like brought in and given the, you know.
Right.
Really, he added a lot of veritas.
And he went, hey, how'd you like to pay Himmler in the sequel?
But going through all of the actors, they all served in the Marines or the Army or the Air Corps. Like this whole cast is that World War II generation.
Yeah.
I think Garner is maybe the youngest, and he was in Korea.
Really?
But a lot of them were World War II vets, various theaters.
I read that Charles Bronson was a coal miner before he became an actor, and so he actually, similar to Pleasance, brought a bunch of like tunneling technique to the film that they didn't have before.
He was like a teenage coal miner, right?
Yeah.
Like
and legit and claustrophobic.
Yeah.
Which is really?
A weird plan B. Like, if this acting thing doesn't work out, I can always go back to coal mining.
Hey, I don't like tight spaces.
You know where he got his name, right? That story. Because he was Charles, you know, insert Polish name.
Brzonskowitz.
And he went to audition at the Paramount Pictures and went through the Bronson Gate. And they asked him what his name was, and that's where he got it, just from the, you know, the Bronson entrance of Paramount Pictures.
That's a cool story.
Yeah.
His Polish last name was just CZK, CZK, CZK.
I kept thinking of the Reservoir Dogs line, too, from the beginning of Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
He's like Charles Bronson in The Great Escape. He's digging tunnels.
I have kind of a three tunnels theory of this movie.
Oh, boy.
Tom Dick go and Harry. On.
They never go in Dick Tunnel, do they?
Sure don't.
They spend all the time in Tom Tunnel and Harry Tunnel.
That's right.
It's too bad. That would have been great for us.
You need to prepare Harry Tunnel before entry, I think.
So which one gets shut down with the discovery of the coffee by the ferret?
Tom Tunnel.
That's okay. Tom, yeah.
Yeah, I was surprised of how little, like, after that, I mean, there was no lockdown. It was just sort of like, well, we found this, and I'm sure you guys weren't doing anything else. Yeah. Carry on.
Well, that was a major operation, that tunnel. That's kind of astonishing that they had three going at the same
time. Well, that's true. I guess that was the point.
I was surprised that the Germans didn't do a little bit more, like, in-your-face dunking on them,
yeah,
having discovered their tunnel when it was nearing completion. Yeah, just like, hoo-ha-ha-ha.
There's not even a hint of a rifle butt smashed against the face of a guy who lives in those barracks.
Nope, they all just come out and go, meh.
Did you miss that part of the story?
It would
like
have been a different
darkness
movie.
Of it?
The thing is, there's even though it's not a comedy, the movie is extremely light. We get a little bit of backstory of everybody.
It's kind of an
10 minutes
movie.
From the end, you're reminded, oh yeah, Nazis are evil.
Yeah, right. People could die, but it's, everyone is friends. There's not a single competition between anyone in the camp.
Yeah.
Nobody is a traitor. Nobody is nobody's a coward even. There are a couple of guys that have some issues, but they're not played like Bronson. His fear is not played as cowardice.
Right.
Right. It almost upsets the apple cart. But anyway, you never get, there's no actual tension. And it's a little bit unreal in the sense that it's a cast of like 15 big stars. There's 600 extras and everybody's a hero.
Yeah. They're having a great time. I mean, like if you believed that they're like focusing 100% of their energy on the escape attempt, you couldn't also hold in your mind that they were like growing enough potatoes to distill 3 huge jugs of moonshine. You know,
it takes a long time to grow a potato, and that many potatoes.
Yeah,
they do interesting things with the passage of time in this film, like with the raking of their of their plots, and then a few scenes later, you see some growth there. Like they are suggesting time passing here.
Yeah, I could never tell when it was because they were singing Christmas carols. But it was also 4th of July.
It should have been really cold during the Christmas carol singing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I feel like it was all, I don't know how much time elapsed at all. Like
that was tough.
And I feel like the director just didn't care.
It seemed like wherever they shot this was super far north because the light is like
outside Munich.
Super angly. Like,
yeah, there was a studio in Munich and they built this like, kind of at the edge of the woods next to the studio. So kind of right beside this is a big, you know, film lot.
Wow.
That's why it was so beautiful after the escape, when we see them.
Yeah, they're in Bavaria.
They're in Bavaria,
gorgeous.
Right?
Yeah.
Not like they're in Poland.
You don't know.
Did you guys pick up on James Coburn being Australian at all?
Oh, I picked up on what a like Mary Poppins, Dick Van Dyke level bad accent he was rocking.
I thought he was American. There was really no hint of an Australian accent.
What's interesting is I don't think they gave him very many lines. He's in the movie a lot and he's doing a lot, but he really chokes his lines back because I think he recognizes and everybody recognizes that he did not nail the accent.
No. I expected him to fuck up everything. Like they spent a lot of time on, boy, his big bag is going to be a problem. Like
the hole.
And I'm like, oh shit, he's the guy that's going to blow it for everyone.
What was in the bag? Why was it so important?
Yeah. I don't know.
That was where the MacGuffin was.
Yeah. He made
They needed that for Pulp Fiction.
How about that pump though that he made? That's pretty cool.
The bellows.
Cool.
Yeah.
That was cool. Like you had, I mean, I never really considered what tunneling out means, but, you know, having to create like a mine shaft basically.
Yeah.
Support it, get air in there, get light in there.
They didn't show it, but there was a scene where he constructed another pump in his barracks, you know, for alone time.
This one's just for me.
Me and my Australian cock.
Oi.
Good day, mate. The concept of the tunnel falling on you, so scary.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe the movie undercuts that a little bit by just dumping like one bag of potting soil on somebody when they need to have that effect.
Yeah.
Like that would be like pretty crushing, right?
If you look at you can go see pictures of the camp where this actually took place, and they have outlined the tunnel dimensions on the ground, so you can kind of walk around and look at where the tunnel started and where it ended, and it's insane. It is insanely long.
Yeah.
And to imagine being in there where your shoulders are touching, your head is touching, like there's just you're not really even enough room, definitely not enough to sit up for that distance. And the idea that any amount of potting soil would fall on you, I was crossing and uncrossing my legs through all of those scenes.
I was not expecting Bronson to pull off the pathos of the lights going out and him being stuck in the tunnel.
Oh, yeah.
But that was legit scary.
Yeah.
He and James Garner really steal the movie for me in terms of, like, realness of performance.
Mm-hmm.
They just were so subtle. And like, you know, Garner doesn't have anything, like, super deep to sink his teeth into like that. But, like, all his, like, little kind of messing with the ferret. The ferret?
The mole?
The mole.
No.
Oh, the ferret. The ferret. Yeah, the guy.
The mole was the
you know,
Scott.
All the like mind games he plays on the German guard and stuff and the kind of like casual bravado he is. Like, hey, I got all those documents that are impossible to get. Here they are. Like,
right.
Like those two performances were just like totally my favorites in the movie.
Apparently he actually was the scrounger in his unit in the Korean War.
Oh, really?
Cool. I had never really heard the term.
Is it a method
actor?
Most
people forget that.
Yeah. That's right. Most people forget James Garner was the scrounger. But it's a great nickname to have. It's a great job in any heist or caper.
Yeah.
Like, I'll be the scrounger.
Yeah.
It's the Shawshank Redemption thing. Like, the guy who can get things is like serves the most useful purpose and is often like the most fun in the group.
Right.
Who can magically just produce.
Yeah. And they also, because that character also always has to have some level of charm.
Yeah.
Because the shit has to come through the guards in most cases.
That day, Danny the Tunnel King crawled through 500 feet of potting soil, came out clean on the other side.
All right. Not bad. The cool
it was bad.
King.
It was bad.
I think I was kind of disappointed. Not disappointed. I'd seen this a few times, but I'd forgotten how sort of jokey McQueen was. Like, this is the least cool Steve McQueen part. He was not McQueen cool. He was, kind of jokey.
I was really
and
surprised by a couple of his facial expressions in this film. Like, when they're about to leave the tunnel and he pops up and he realizes that they're short.
Yeah.
And McQueen scrabbles back down and he's like, I need the rope. And then he like presents the case in the tunnel for the new plan, the plan B. They stay on him for a moment and he like makes his pitch and he's like, he makes this weird clown face about it. I don't know what that was about. He was making a lot of those choices throughout the film.
I mean, he shines with the motorcycle stuff. That's when he becomes cool. And all that stuff is genuinely fucking cool.
Yeah.
To see, like, it's clearly him. He didn't do the jump, which at the time was, like, one of the greatest stunts ever performed.
Yeah.
Just that jump over the barbed wire.
I think it's still considered a pretty great stunt.
Yeah, like, when you think about the kind of motorcycles they had, it wasn't, like, you know, it wasn't a stunt cycle. They just, like, painted this big Triumph or whatever green.
The choice of composition for that jump, I think, is so great because, like, Sturgis was never... he never thought about A-teaming that sequence.
Right.
He like shot it wide at like 3/4, like a little bit above. Like you see the whole thing.
Yeah.
And its realism is like unquestioned. It's great.
Yeah.
No trickery involved.
Yeah. I love how they made that barbed wire. Did you read about this?
No.
Like Sturgis had everyone on the entire crew from like crafty to camera people to electricians make rubber barbed wire barbs and then tie them to a longer piece of rubber.
Just like in their spare time?
Yeah, and so that length of barbed wire that's jumped and then landed in later is all rubber. It's all rubberized and it's made by the entire crew like a quilt.
That's pretty cool.
It is really fucked up to see him like languishing in the
He really sells it.
Yeah.
I had a experience as a kid where I was like on a camping trip or something and had never encountered the concept of barbed wire before and tried
you
to
escape
jump
from
over
the
a fence.
Tennis academy.
And like I was like really squirming.
Listen to that, John. Raised without barbed wire.
Oh, can you imagine what that would have been like?
That's called privilege, folks.
Just free roaming.
I laugh, but we had barbed wire. We had a barbed wire dog pen. So,
wow.
I mean, it wasn't all. Well, it wasn't razor wire.
We found out last night you had goats.
I had goats and dogs in the same pen.
Goats that you showed it's pretty interesting. Dirty magazines to.
We won't get into that. What was your take on the mole? Sort of a underused character, I think, in some ways.
There seemed to be a lot more like consciousness of what his mental status was on the like leadership part than they show on screen. Like everybody's like, you know, he's close to breaking.
I know.
Good boy.
And I'm like, is he?
It didn't seem like that.
Like, he seems all right to me.
He was starting to come unraveled. He was spending all that time, that bravado time in the cooler.
But they never show any of that.
They don't, but I think it's got to be harder to sit in that cooler for 20 days than it looks. And Steve McQueen was making the case, kind of again like Bridge on the River Kwai, like, I can take it, right? Yeah. Put me in the cooler over and over, I don't care.
I would say that cooler is 20% worse if you're in the one next to Steve McQueen bouncing his fucking baseball.
Yeah. That's what drove him mad. Yeah. That fucking baseball.
You know that baseball is driving him batty, old boy.
I like that the mole had a molish face. He really looked like his nickname to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do you hate the Scottish people?
Not all Scots.
The guard in the cooler was like, boy, you really can't have any job other than German soldier. With a face like that.
I don't know if this is true or not, but my feeling was that the soldier that ultimately captured Steve McQueen in the barbed wire was that guy.
Oh.
And I didn't rewind to put it all together, but it really felt like they lingered on the soldier's face.
That's some nice headcanon.
And it was like, oh, it's him.
God, that guy has some bone structure, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that guy was the guy, but... How many guys can there be?
I'm going to scrub through and see if I can verify. You guys keep talking.
Scrubbing through. I feel like I'd seen that ferret guy before. What has he been in?
All these dudes were in everything.
Robert Groff. They all had German accents, which is, for the time, a little different. Because, you know, famously, the sort of British accent for any German.
Right.
But
works less well if everybody.
Yeah, they really made the
British distinction,
I think. And I think even had some real Germans like playing some of these roles.
Yeah. Yeah, I think like a couple of the Germans had like experiences similar to the jobs that they were portraying also.
Yeah, wartime experience.
Do you feel like it was too long?
Ha! Yes! 3 hours long.
I think it's a different German that captures Steve McQueen.
A different German. Okay. Yeah.
But is it too long?
Tell me if you agree.
It does feel like it dragged a little bit.
There's that guy, and then where's the other guy?
I don't know. Those are the two guys.
All right. Oh, the two guys side by side?
Yeah.
Oh.
Anyways. It's long, but I feel like it's like the summer movie event of 1968?
63.
What's the difference, guys, honestly?
There's an enormous difference between 1963 and 1968.
I was about to say, yeah.
Whereas there is no difference between 1994 and 1997.
You're probably right. I felt like it did, even though I'd seen this movie a few times, I felt like it dragged a little bit for the first time. I was aware of how long that first 2 hours was without a lot of like... It's kind of repetitious in parts with the cooler stuff, and I felt like they could have kind of gotten through that a little quicker.
Yeah.
The payoff of all that hard work being the tunnel, the getting everybody out scene, where we see all the work that we've watched meticulously put together for 2 hours, then we start to see it unfold. And there's really nothing that they build in the first 2 hours that we don't see it employed in that scene. The pump, the ventilation, the ID cards, the, you know, like each thing then has its reappearance.
Right.
But I'm not sure we needed, it feels like one of those things if you'd taken a minute here, a minute there, a minute here, a minute there.
Right.
You could have made it
tighten it up by half an hour or something.
Yeah, but there wasn't any one thing, there wasn't a character you didn't want to see or any one thing you didn't
care aren't
about.
Any scenes that feel like they're... fat, though, you know? Like, I feel like every scene kind of unfolds at a pace that feels right to me. It's just that there's a lot of scenes. Like, there's so many set pieces. Like, I feel like
everybody gets their feature.
Yeah. It might be the kind of movie that's tough to cut stuff from because, you know, each scene kind of, like, leads right into the next. Like, there's so much connective tissue in the script. Like, the 4th of July scene leading to Tom being discovered by the Germans and like that like emotional arc is, it doesn't work if you cut out the fun and games with distilling the moonshine, which is the scene right before it, you know? So
I think I just could have used more threat and menace. Although clearly Sturgis was going for just sort of a light adventure film.
Yeah.
Like that wasn't the movie he was making, but I could have used more cooler time of like despair and maybe the Germans really shaking them down after they find the first tunnel. And it was all just sort of Hogan's Heroes jokes. It's all very light.
Do you think that tone for so long makes the moment where they're executed outside the truck more acute? Like, do you think that really fucked people up in 63?
Probably. Because, you know, and
it kind of comes out of nowhere, right?
I've never felt more alive. Was like one of the last things he says
before
they get mowed down. That was pretty tough.
And we get that contrast that, again, you do see in Hogan's Heroes, which is that when the Gestapo arrives, you're reminded, there are baddies out there. And these guys are bad.
You guys know what a Hogan's Heroes is?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the TV show that was kind of a copy of Stalag 17.
Yeah,
right?
We watched Stalag 17 and talked about Hogan's Heroes.
Oh, that's right.
Hogan was the mug that Conan O'Brien had on his desk for a long time, right?
Oh, no. He had Eisenhower, I think. Wasn't that an Eisenhower mug? I
thought that was Colonel Klink that he had on his desk, yeah.
Is this going to segue into a conversation about the sexual proclivities of Bob Crane?
I'll always do five tight minutes on Bob Crane.
Is it also that, like, the scariness of Nazis is more like contemporary in 1963? Like, is a Western audience still like trying to kind of dispel some of a horror of World War II by making a lighter movie like this in 1963?
It was a gradual realization. We've talked about before over 20 years how bad it was, because there was a lot of whitewashing. But I think the nice Germans, or the fact that the Germans were in this movie mostly portrayed sympathetically,
right,
was a thing you wouldn't see now. Right? Would you go see a World War II movie now and have any German be like, yes, I'm more or less a reasonable man?
Not unless it was sort of a spoofy send-up of like Hogan's Heroes.
They would either be like, I'm on your side, or, I mean, it'd be played much more broadly than this, which is kind of like, I'm doing my job, I'm a member of the German military, but I'm not a monster.
I remember that. Thinking it was really interesting, the scenes around the train, like there's a lot of like interesting social interactions, like the SS guy like with his feet up on the bench, and
which doesn't seem like something an SS soldier would do. That seems sort of casual. That might be pedantic.
They had a lot of SS privilege.
And then when they get off, there's like a Hitler youth kid in like short shorts and like handing a lady out handing out flyers, and I was like, are those like true believers?
Did you say short shorts?
Yeah, he's got like black shorts that are like, they're like real up high. No?
Short shorts.
Maybe I'm misremembering. I don't know.
No, they were pretty short, but that was the style in 63.
Did you guys think about what sort of tunnel person you would be? And this is a little bit guy adjacent, but like when people were popping up out of the tunnel and then running for the forest, a few of them would, you know, throw their bag up, pop up, look around, periscope like, and then run for the forest. And then other people would just get up and run, trusting the rope signal to tell them that no one was watching. I feel like Yeah, I would have a hard time running for the forest, not looking behind me at any point. And that was some of the most nerve-wracking sequences of the film for me, was seeing all the differences in how people approach that strategy of escape.
Yeah.
I would have been the guy that went back and found the surveyor and was like, what the fuck, man? You really left us out to dry here. We're 14 feet shy.
Yeah, they kind of started a little bit of that. This is supposed to be an accurate survey. But they were like, you know, don't waste time arguing about that. We're fucking shy.
Yeah.
So let's just go.
Yeah.
Well, and the surveyor ended up being the one that attracted the attention of the guard in the first place.
He really blew it.
Because he had the big white paper package, which seems like a dumb thing.
He wrapped his bag in bubble wrap. Yeah, you just can't do that.
You gotta go with a low albedo package to take in your...
But also, why did any of those guys have packages? I mean, you know, it's
every single one of them has an item that they're carrying with them.
Well, they talk about provisions and rations, like, I guess...
Oh, that's a good point. Sandwiches.
They had some stuff. Yeah, they had their sandwiches.
But in terms of, like...
Well, when they make the action figures, they want them each to have an accessory, too.
Yeah. That's right.
In terms of which tunnel guy you would be, I think that's a really interesting question because, of course, there were hundreds of guys that helped build it that didn't go.
Yeah.
And not just because it was cut short, but there were a lot of people that either opted out or weren't chosen.
You want to talk about darkness unseen in this film? Like, they never cut back to a barracks of a guy washing his hands after having dug the tunnel, knowing that everyone's leaving but him.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, because everybody was in on it. There wasn't a single person in the camp.
Yeah.
It was just, like, unaware that this was happening.
Is it part of it that, like, they needed to be plausible? Like, they do all that testing of, like, can you present your papers and kind of carry on the like, functionary
German plausibly? Oh, like, you have to audition almost.
Plausibly.
Yeah.
I'm sure anybody that could speak German or French had a better chance than somebody with a deep Southern accent.
I've always wondered, like, would a slightly bad French accent be detectable to an average German security officer? Like, because their French is not perfect at all.
Right.
When they're, like, on the train and they're saying, like, je suis français aussi. Right. And the guy hands them their papers back. Like, I guess I just don't know because I don't live in Europe, but like, would they know, or were we just asked to suspend disbelief there?
Totally depend on who you encountered, right? I mean, there was an entire movie going audience that was expected to accept James Coburn as Australian. So accent sensitivity isn't
right.
But like, that's a big scene in Inglourious Basterds, right? Where he's finally discovered by the way he holds up his fingers to indicate three,
right?
Whether he
that felt like a nod to this a little bit,
yeah,
for sure,
yeah,
that because he gets busted at the end with, was he the one that earlier had said,
McDonald's,
that's how you're going to get find out,
he was portraying the Nazi officer in the practice run,
right,
and
that undoes him.
Good
in the
luck,
end.
Yeah, it's very good. That's a great line reading,
right?
Good luck.
So is that guy just going around saying that to everybody, just testing them? Or he's been scrambled because they know a huge jailbreak has taken place.
I mean, the thing that you have to wonder is any male civilian in Germany at this point.
Yeah, they're all like of war fighting age, right?
Yeah, right. So why aren't you in the army?
Yeah.
Would be the automatic question that you would ask anytime you saw a 35-year-old guy walking.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so
I would dress up as an old.
But like, they didn't have to.
Hey, you're never too old for the Volkster.
Why are you? Why are you a little later?
Or get like a cane or something and act like, you know, you clearly have some sort of malady.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah. Why more people didn't affect a limp?
Get some
trying to escape.
Put some tar on a couple of your teeth. Be like, these teeth, I can't be in the military. I'd be no good.
But you know, they did check papers of people just in Germany at the time. It was part of the...
Just walking around?
Yeah, it was just part of the control system of the Nazis to have everybody always spying on each other and...
It's kind of like how you have to show your driver's license at the airport now, man.
Yeah, man. It's kind of like when the cops pull you over and they want to see your ID. It's bullshit.
I liked how the... how it was like, you know, one by air, two by sea, one guy on a motorcycle, guy on a Coburn the Aussie on his bicycle. The
Which
guys
was
on the train.
Genius. The bicycle. That was absolutely some of the best escape for me. Is just like, oh, you get on a bike. Nobody's going to stop you.
Bling, yeah. Bling.
Just to go on a bike. You could ride for weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What
that's a
fun
good point.
Trip.
That plane escape scene was fun too.
Yeah.
Though starting the motor of an aircraft without being able to see has got to be the scariest thing
right.
possible, right?
Boy, don't go that way once you hear Oof. The motor, the engine crank.
Yeah, I thought Pleasance was great at portraying someone who's blind
he
or has severely compromised vision. Like, that seems like there's act drunk as a difficult thing to do, and then act blind has got to be a totally different cat. Like, he was great at that.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, those flying scenes were gorgeous. Yeah.
What kind of plane was pedant. That? I mean, that plane...
That plane
authentic.
Was real, but it's T-6s all the time in these war
that's
films.
Right. So all the planes on the runway there, on the taxiway, they were all T-6 Texans, which is weird that at that point, which are American.
Okay.
Those are also the stand-in planes for Japanese Zeros in a lot of these movies.
Yeah.
Right.
They were American trainers that we had a lot of.
Yeah.
But you would think a movie of this kind of budget that was filming in Germany could have come up with a couple of
Focke-Wulfs
or whatever.
Hmm.
Yeah, I liked how low he was flying too, just sort of skirting the treetops. Which
there's not like radar cover to be worried about at this point, is there? Within German airspace, they didn't have radar, did they?
Who the fuck is running that airbase? Also, they never launch a fighter after the guy. They just watch him go.
Is it just that he gets too much of a head start? They would never be able to catch him.
Well, feels like he'd want to at least try.
Yeah, because you would be, shot or something.
That's clearly
the
slowest plane on the field
kind
that
of
they
nothing.
Took.
Yeah, right.
I ran out with a pistol.
He really had the jump on us, so. Yeah. They did have radar in World War II, but maybe not like ground radar at a training airbase.
I thought the British were the only ones with radar.
Radar,
wrong about that?
Radar was invented and developed and perfected throughout the course of the war. So. I mean, it was in its infancy.
Yeah.
As plane crashes go, though, for the time, not bad. It came in pretty hot and got clipped by that tree. I mean, it was believable enough.
Yeah, they wrecked that plane.
Yeah.
So is James Garner a Eagle Squadron guy? Like, he's an American in a
Who joined the
British...
Canadian... He joined the Canadian Air Force to fight before we entered the war.
Wow.
So there were quite a few of those American pilots.
He's Ben Affleck, but...
Right.
That,
exactly.
That didn't go fight in Pearl Harbor.
Wasn't
also
in the Doolittle raid and also in the... But there was one of the people that escaped, one of the actual people that escaped during the real escape was a Doolittle raider.
Wow.
One of those Doolittle raiders made it through China, got repatriated.
Wow.
And then went to Europe and flew as a bomber pilot. Got shot down and was at the camp and was part of this whole escape.
Where is that movie? Holy
what
crap.
A life.
Well, it's Pearl Harbor starring Ben Affleck, except we didn't really focus on him as much as we could have. Yeah, that guy, incredible life. Incredible.
So how many people got out? Is it 70-something?
Oh, 76, and three of them actually made it.
Wow.
And in real life, the three that made it, two of them were Norwegians and one of them was Dutch. So... No Americans or British or anything like that survived.
Hmm.
And presumably because they probably had pretty good language.
Yeah, they could blend in a little bit better. Yeah. You know, it struck me that like the escape in Europe is greatly aided by everybody's like European heritage. Like I guess most of them are British, but like the couple of Americans, like you couldn't have this movie in a war in Afghanistan. Like nobody would buy it, or
in the Japanese theater. That was that was the thing about the Doolittle Raider movie was these guys were in China and
they stood out like sore thumbs.
Yeah, it wasn't going to be. It's not possible to hide them or deny they'd been there.
Well, and there's no fence in Bridge on the River Kwai. It's like, where are you going to go?
Right,
dork.
Yeah, I like the resistance scene in the cafe.
Yeah.
That I kind of had forgotten about that, and that took me by surprise a bit when Coburn got up, the phone rang, and they basically he was like, you might want to.
I love the physical comedy of that scene where the two guys do the elevator behind the bar and get behind it.
Yeah. And then he's like, it's a nice flourish. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're doing the canoe? Oh, cool.
My daughter loves that bit. Yeah, but that was a straight up drive-by.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
These guys are just having some. What were they having, by the way? It was something.
They're having Pernod.
Yeah, little, yeah, Pernod, right?
But you mix it with water.
It's a pastis. Yeah, it's a little like absinthe.
Okay.
Pernod makes an absinthe, but I don't think it's their absinthe that they were drinking. But it's like, I think everybody in France is either like a Pernod person or a Ricard person. They all like have a feeling about which is the better one to drink, and they are owned by liquor mega conglomerate Pernod Ricard. So it's like,
are you more of a graveyard man? You'll just pour them both into the same glass.
Every nation of Europe has an anisette, a little like aperitif,
right?
And they all taste exactly the same. And I'm sorry to say this to all the people out there who are like, no, ouzo is amazing.
Oof.
They all just are. They taste like licorice and they are awful.
Was that realistic though for three German officers in an afternoon just sitting down at a cafe and having some drinks? Like everything just seems so. None of it seemed like wartime.
Well, they were occupied France, so
some of them might have been Vichy Frenchies in German uniforms. I think. I don't think that we got enough of them talking to establish whether they were of German or French extraction. But
before D-Day, there were Germans all throughout France, and it was kind of like considered a posh place to sit out the war, right? Because they're not on the Russian front. They're just there having Pernod.
Yeah.
Sitting out the war al fresco. Yeah.
Little did they know.
They really, not great reflexes on those officers when they stand up and see. Whoa, that guy's got a belt-fed machine gun coming out of the back of that Citroën. What?
So the three, Coburn makes it, right? Presumably.
Mm-hmm.
And the three, and it's Bronson and the other guy, and their rowboat, which again was just rowboat. Genius.
Yeah.
They had a really easy time of it.
They rowed right up to that Swedish boat.
It happened to have a ladder right there at water level.
Trick Swedish boats where they drop the panels on the sides and it's suddenly a German warship.
Sturgis paid the captain of that bigger boat to turn around and position in the right light for that scene.
I kept waiting on a Nazi jet ski to come around the corner.
There was a goof on IMDb about that scene too, because there's like automated container cranes in the background of that scene, and that's like a 1950s and more recent invention. Like containerization wasn't invented until after the war, which is like so weird to think about. Like, I mean, like the biggest project of moving crap all over the planet, and they didn't have shipping containers. they just had stevedores, like manually unloading ships.
It's a good union job.
Yeah. Not anymore. That's why stevedores are always throwing their wooden shoes into the container cranes these days.
Well, if you haven't heard this show before, I think one of the things you have to do on a movie podcast is review the film, and for every film...
We didn't know that when we first started our movie podcast.
How many episodes did we go before we figured out we had to
review
them?
I think it was super early.
Yeah, it wasn't many.
I think it was like 12.
What?
Yeah.
No.
Because we had a listener make like a spreadsheet of all our rankings and share it with us recently.
Oh, no.
I think it was.
And he kind of dragged us for not reviewing a bunch of the movies.
That's really helpful.
There was one episode, I might be wrong, that I remember you guys, one of you went through your spiel but never said what the actual rating was.
Oh, yeah. Well, we cut the boring stuff out.
I might be wrong, but it's like, wait a minute. It's like, you reviewed it, but you didn't.
We suck at this, Chuck. We're bad.
We've learned a lot while making this show.
What else has bothered me about your show? All right, Adam.
Adam,
take
it
away.
So
that's the one that bothers
me. The rule is, like for every war film we discuss, so too is attached a custom rating system. We do that so that films aren't compared to one another.
Right.
Which is like totally ignored by this guy with this spreadsheet. It's not like he has different columns for all of our different rating systems.
Yeah, that guy's got it all wrong.
He's reverting it to stars, and that's not what they are, man.
Oh, no, he needs to have a new column on his spreadsheet that describes the the rating.
Is he doing method. Rating erasure and substituting with stars? Because that is fucked up.
I mean, just to throw off all the math, I'm retroactively reviewing all of the movies that we did not give reviews to 1 star. They all sucked.
Yeah.
Tough but fair. I think we talked a lot about the tone of this film and maybe the issues we had with it being not quite as dark as war films typically are for their time. And there is an item in the film, I think, that embodies that feeling the most. It's a scene between Blythe and Henley where Blythe is making his shitty tea and he can't do it without the milk. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you know, in a POW camp, you can make tea that's all right. But if you really want to class it up, you need the milk. And almost immediately, Blythe returns with the milk and changes the whole game. And it's...
Henley returns with the milk.
And Henley returns with the milk and changes the whole game. And it's really, like, that's the sensibility of the film. This is milk in your World War II film tea. This is, like, an enjoyable war film hang that is not meant to evoke a sense of roughing it or darkness or hardship in any way.
There's no menace, not much at least.
Yeah, and that is one aspect to the film that is unfortunate for a film that I approached expecting greatness.
Yeah.
The other aspect to it is that we have been watching a lot of ensemble films where you get hyper-efficient character development. And I think one of the ways that this film does not succeed entirely for me is that these characters are defined by what they do and not who they are.
Right.
And to me, a nickname is not a substitution for a character.
Yeah.
And for as much time as this film takes to give you plot and for what you guys believe to be deep character development, I didn't get that feeling much.
Yeah.
And a lot of these characters felt the same to me, other than their nickname. And so, like, while I liked the film a lot, I did not love it, and those are two ways that I didn't. And so for that reason, I'm going to give it a good but not great 4 cans of milk.
4 cans.
4 cans.
That's still a pretty thick rating. That's some, that's some thick milk. That's the
that's whole milk.
I don't like tea. I don't like milk in my tea either.
You're crazy. Oh, milk in your tea is great.
It's the best.
Really?
Yeah.
It really is?
You need to reprogram your brain a little bit because you spent a lot of time being the enemy of milk in all things.
It's true.
Now that milk is back on the menu, boys.
All right.
I think you should give it another chance.
Yeah, let's have some milky tea together later.
Great. I'm into it.
All right.
This is a classic for me and one that I love rewatching. I have nostalgia for watching it with my mom and dad when I was a kid, and I feel like it's still great. And I love all the characters in it, and I think that I think it's going to be one of the movies that I revisit throughout my life. So I'll give it 4.5 cans of milk.
Hmm. So I found myself when I watch movies for Movie Crush through a more studied lens and a more critical eye than just every other time I've seen this film, I found myself liking this one a little less than I had in the past. It felt a little long and a little too light and goofy at times with the McQueen stuff. I think I would have, like I mentioned earlier, it could have used a little more menace. A little more, like, show the mole losing his mind in that cooler a little bit. Don't just say, well, he's going mad, and then he has his one scene where he, you know, runs and, you know, does suicide by cop, basically. So I found myself a little more critical this time for a movie that in the past I just sort of enjoyed thoroughly. So I'm gonna take it back to... I'm going to take it back to 4 cans of milk, which is still high, but I previously probably would have been in the 4.5 range.
Well, You don't have to. You don't have to be influenced by me.
I'm not.
Good.
In no way is he influenced by you.
Good.
Yeah, I'm. I agree with you, Chuck. I have watched this movie a bunch of times. This was like late night television with my dad. Watching, I've seen this movie on a black and white TV. I've seen it on an early color TV. And
how does it look in black and white? Because I feel like it's a very spectacular movie, and you shoot a little differently for color than you do for black and white. But this is in the era when I think they probably had to think about both.
Yeah, Panavision is not like super snappy colors. It's all pretty muted.
Yeah.
And I mean, the colors are beautiful, but they're not like hyper real.
They're not Avengers Endgame or Thor Ragnarok right. level.
But at the time, during the black and white television era, you didn't really think about it. You just, that was what you got.
Right.
Yeah. You get what you get and you don't get upset.
That's right. but watching it this time, I realized, yeah, it's like a boy's life movie. They're at camp. Camp isn't that bad. They're away from their moms and dads, which is sad. And the beds are uncomfortable. But, you know, there's never even like those trick beds
that you fall through three bunks on.
Yeah, like that moment is so goofy.
Yeah, it's goofy. And the camera really lingers on him being like,
yeah.
But, you know, we never talk about.
Is that the comeuppance that Cavendish gets for doing a bad survey?
And for attracting the attention of the guard? Cavendish could get a lot worse in this movie.
Yeah.
Named after my favorite variety of banana, though.
Boy, cool. That one really took off.
Yeah. But we never, you know, we never confront lice. We never see a latrine, right? They don't. We don't see them digging or cleaning a latrine or latrine at all. It's just not even in the movie. And so
the lack of toilets.
Why are
really...
you so obsessed with poops and peas, John?
Well, I'm auditioning to be on Greatest Gen. but I feel like that's an example of how much, I mean, there's a lot of this movie that's like, no, the war was just, it was just a lark, but this movie really, really washed it clean. And so you have to ask, like, what is the message of this movie vis-a-vis war? And it's from that era of just like, war is good sport. And this is right before Vietnam kicked off. 63 is still in a time when the Greatest Generation is still young and still dominating the culture, and we still believe that war is just and that we defeated the Hun. And we're only a few years away from the country taking a dramatic turn in how it thinks about war. And so you could get away with a movie like this. And I think if this movie came out in 68, it would start to look like John Wayne's Green Berets, where the culture would have responded to it like, this is corny.
Right.
The country evolved so much in the next 5 years.
Yeah.
Does the
fact that it comes out in the era before that mean that like there's no sense even subconsciously that they're working in defiance of a shift in the mood, so it doesn't have that corniness to it?
There's no defiance in it because the only alternative culture at the time was like beat poets or whatever, but there was nobody was making a critique of the US war machine,
right?
Except like Eisenhower kind of generally saying, hey, look out for
this. Hey, I could see there being a potential downside to this. Yeah.
But like a bunch of British guys in a prison camp, like making a Rube Goldberg escape machine. It was just for fun. And so a 3-hour caper movie with no complexity was harder to watch this time and just surrender to. I had, and maybe it's because we've been doing this podcast and looking at war movies, I've started to wonder what is this movie saying about war? And this movie isn't saying much. That said, as a boy, the idea of escaping from a prison camp and trying to make it across Germany without getting caught and not speaking German was a like from watching this movie for the first time when I was probably 7 or 8, that became a constant fantasy game for me.
It was like a foundational element of your personality. It
really is, right? I mean, every time
that's what this movie was made for, though, I think, looking back. It was made for, like, dads and their sons to go see sort of a fun adventure film.
Yeah. Anytime I was alone in town or in Anchorage, anywhere, walking alone, I immediately was like, I'm in Nazi Germany, and I'm going to make it all the way home without anybody, figuring out that I'm an escaped prisoner.
That's adorable.
Big time, right? I still think about it. When I lay in bed last night, I was like, okay, how would I make it from here if I was in enemy territory?
Few people compare Max von Kahn with Nazi Germany.
but I have to, I have to ding it for the reasons that you described. So I'm going to say that it's when you're somewhere else, you're making some tea, you want a little milk, and someone's playing
trombone in the next room.
You're looking for some milk, and you open up the little mini fridge in the dressing room, and there's a thing of milk in there, but it's open.
Yeah.
And so you open it up, you lift it up, and you kind of give it a sniff. To see,
I was hoping this would happen.
To see if it's like still good, because it could have been.
Funny you bring
that
up, because we're in the midst of our Friendly Fire tour as of this record, and we were in a green room and found just such a carton of milk in Seattle, I want to say, and I wasn't having coffee, but somehow I was the one that got nominated to smell the milk.
Mm.
How did that happen?
That's your call sign,
milk smeller.
Smell the milk. So I'm going to give it
this is milk smeller. That's a big 10 for.
Three unopened cans of milk and one open can of milk.
Suspicious open can.
Where you're like, it could be a full and fresh and delicious can, but there's the uncertainty whether or not this can has been sitting out.
Un poquito sospechoso.
Yes.
Great rating. So the other thing we always do on Friendly Fire is we pick the guy that we spotted in the film that we most identify with. Chuck, do you want to lead us off? Who's your guy?
Yeah, so there's a moment. They're rehearsing Christmas carols through a lot of this movie.
To cover up that they're like banging on, on ductwork that they're manufacturing surreptitiously. Exactly.
Nothing covers that up than like nine guys singing Silent Night.
Five gold rings.
Clink. So there was one of those moments where who was the guy? Is it Cavendish?
Surveyor?
Yeah, the choir leader.
Yeah.
And
surveyor and choir leader. Yeah. Not that great at either.
The shot was from behind him facing the choir. And I don't know if you remember, but there was this one guy on the left of the frame that by all accounts should have been just hidden behind the guy in front of him. And he was completely leaning out to the left to show his face.
Yeah.
And was not very expressive. He looked like a bad extra. Leaning way out to the side. I don't know if you noticed
that. I totally noticed that guy.
But,
that's a great guy.
Yeah, that was my guy. That would have been me trying to get a little screen time.
Mom, look, there
yeah,
I am!
Yeah, exactly.
My guy is Tunnel King Willie, who is the... There's the two diggers. Danny is the Charles Bronson character, and Willie is the other one who really... it's kind of a thankless thing that he does, but he really like goes out on a limb for Danny and really, really cares about him and makes sure that he gets through the tunnel, but also in a way that like he can cope with. And I think, I think you guys made some good points about the kind of lack of characterization in the film, but I thought that was a very like human and humane thing, and I liked that they had that kind of that bond with each other that they could trust each other that much. And I thought it was so awesome that they that Willie saw Danny through the escape and then they actually make it in the end.
Yeah.
So Willie was my guy for doing Danny that solid.
How great would it have been if the continuation of this movie was those guys just in a relationship together in Switzerland.
Yeah.
Just like walking down this cobblestone street holding hands.
Well, so from the beginning
of
the movie...
Hey, you said you'd go get some milk and bread.
When they first appear...
You didn't. You're dead.
This ain't over.
When they first appear, there is... At the beginning of the movie, right, they're always together, these two. And yeah. there is an extremely homoerotic feeling to their relationship.
Yeah.
They're similarly sized. They're very touchy with each other from the beginning.
They're the Tunnel Kings. I mean, and come on.
They have a they have several moments, including that one where
which
Bronson's
one's the
like,
tunnel though? It's not me, baby. I'm the pick.
They switch off. They're both diggers.
It's pretty clear who's the bottom here.
There's the moment where Bronson takes the shower, and I think it's the Australian guy that's like, I'm a lifeguard. I'm watching him take a shower.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
I'd be watching too, man.
Yeah.
Charles Bronson with his shirt off back then was
leathering up my crank.
Oh. Anyways, you were making a point, John.
Oh no, I think the point's made.
I really like Willie in that scene, Ben, because he, like, his encouragement is never shaming.
Yeah, there's no judgment of this being a big problem for Danny.
And it's never made into a, you're going to fuck us if you don't go through the tunnel. Like kind of a lot is riding on you, buddy. It's always like, you dug the tunnel, man. It's only right that you go through. Just summon the courage for the 5 minutes you needed.
We're going to get through, and then we're going to be out.
And that was an area that it could have gone dark and didn't.
He really cares about him. And in a way, that's the only relationship between anybody in this movie where you feel, except for Garner and Pleasance.
Yeah, Garner and Pleasance have a very similar.
Yeah, very sweet relationship.
And they also play chess with each other. So there's another element to it. So it's a very three-dimensional human relationship is what I'm trying to say.
So who's your guy?
Did you already?
Oh, I haven't done my guy. No.
Okay. Well, I mean,
I'll do my guy.
Yeah, I'd like to hear it.
My guy is the German officer who is like in charge of the camp, and not the commandant, but the officer. He's the tallest guy in the movie, and he's the day to day running the camp guy.
Yeah,
he's got a lot of the. So the commandant has gold epaulets, which means he's like a general staff officer in the Luftwaffe. This guy has red epaulets, which means he's in the Luftwaffe, but he's a artillery officer. Mm. So something happened in his career where he ended up here. This isn't like, this wasn't his original job.
Well, he was working at a secret sub base in the North Sea. And he bullseyed an American submarine as it was leaving their compound. And they're like, you get any job you want. What do you want?
but of all the, I mean, we've talked a lot about the kind of humanizing of the Germans. But this guy is just a mensch, right? He's the one with the pitchfork.
Right.
But he's clearly doing it not intending to stab anybody. He's doing it as theater.
I guess I got to use the damn pitchfork.
Yeah, like, here we go. He's the one that recognizes. He pulls guys out of the line. He pulled Bronson out of the line because he knew him by name.
He's like memorized the Facebook of the incoming class of Stalag Luft 3 or whatever.
Right. But he's never cruel to anybody. He's the guy that discovers the tunnel. Like, he's the main...
He's never punitive.
Never. He's the main sort of German antagonist, but you also get the feeling that you could just sit around with this guy, and he's like a... He just... I liked him from the moment he arrived on the screen, and like, through the whole movie. The one person that I felt bad about in this movie was when the escape was made. Like, he was gonna... Although, wait! No, that's the best part about this guy. The commandant loses his job, and he still has... He's still standing there on the porch when the new commandant comes. Like, he's there getting it done. Never does anybody a mean.
Yeah. Only in The Great Escape can you be like, the Nazi running the prisoner of war camp, great guy.
He's just
really kind of a sweetheart.
Yeah.
The idea of there being a Nazi mensch.
Yeah.
Right.
He's not a
Nazi, hell of
though.
A combination.
He's not a Nazi. He's just a German doing his German job.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're always at great pains to make that distinction, John.
I know. Both sides.
You see my guy in maybe the most stressful part of the film, which is the train station scene. And the reason it's so stressful in that moment is because they're so close to the end, and yet they're all together in such close proximity to being caught. Like, they're out in the open, and yet they're confined, and yet they're about to go into an even more confined space. Mm-hmm. So the entire scene is very pregnant with guys, like, looking at each other, like, going, when the fuck is this train going to be here? It's nuts. And when the train finally arrives, so too does my guy, because we cut to a shot of the train coming at screen.
Yeah.
Which is my
Adam, I heard you yelling in your hotel room last night.
There is a guy standing a foot away from the rails as the steam engine comes through and does not flinch or move whatsoever, and it comes a foot away from his face.
You admired that because you were watching it on your iPad screen and you ran out of the room.
I think that guy low-key steals the scene because of that. Like, that feeling of dread of, oh my God, the train's finally coming. And then things just don't feel right in that scene at all, because there are Nazis there and there are cops there and so are our heroes, and we're waiting and just waiting and waiting. And then when the train comes, like, it's only going to get worse. And people don't look like they're acting right. And one of the things that embodies that is that guy just not moving next to the train, and it's creepy.
Yeah, I don't think I noticed that.
And that guy's my guy for it.
Yeah. Is the implication that the commandant is going to be put to death over this?
Sent to the Russian front or something, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, he was a known quantity too, and I think he did get sent to the Russian front in real life.
Kind of a menschy Nazi.
Yeah.
He wasn't as menschy.
You guys should pick another film.
The way we pick our movie on Friendly Fire is we roll a 100-sided die.
Man, I wanted to see that thing.
And so, well, I have it right here. So here we go. We're going to roll the 100-sided die. Ready?
Wow. That's some stellar Foley work.
Yeah. This podcasting thing doesn't work yet. You've got a job in production sound. Oh, and you're dripping coffee on your shelf.
Was it worth it, John? Was it worth it?
72.
72 is a 2018 movie about a war correspondent called A Private War. Oh, this is that one with, what's her nose?
Brand new, right?
Yeah, it's brand new. What's the lady in that called?
This is going great.
I'm trying to click on the link and it doesn't work because it's the stupid app.
I'll look it up.
I've never heard of this movie. Cate Blanchett, Emily Blunt. Rachel Weisz.
Oh, Rosamund Pike. It's Rosamund Pike playing a war correspondent. She's got like the eye patch on the poster.
Oh.
This was on every bus bench in LA for like 1 week.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I don't really know anything about this one, but I think I basically put it on our list on the strength of it being...
The bus ads worked, huh?
A bus ad movie with the word war in the title, so...
I guess sometimes it's all it takes. To cover up part of Rosamund Pike's face for the film.
One of the most celebrated war correspondents of our time, Mari Colvin, is an utterly fearless and rebellious spirit driven to the front line of conflicts across the globe to give voice to the voiceless. Wow. So that'll be next week on Friendly Fire.
Based on the poster, it doesn't appear that she gives sight to the sightless.
Wow. Sick burn.
I regret the toilet is a great way to finish this episode.
I love that Roderick just left the show.
See you,
John.
Great, amazing show. Love to be on the podcast.
Really big timed us. I guess we'll leave it with Robs from there. So for John Roderick, Adam Pranica, and the great Chuck Bryant, I've been Ben Harrison. To the victor, go the spoiler alerts.
All right, everyone, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I like this little tradition, recording a show with these guys, crossing over. I'm always curious to see if they edit theirs down in a different way, so I might even listen to their version rather than my own. Those guys are great, though. They do a good job on that show. You can check out Ben and Adam if you like what they're throwing down. And if you're a Star Trek fan, you would love The Greatest Generation. That's a show that really put those guys on the map. And if you like Mr. John Roderick, well, I mean, he has a host of things. You can listen to the Omnibus podcast, which is great. You can listen to Roadwork. You can listen to On the Line with John Roderick. Is there another one, Ramsey? I feel like John has four shows. Oh, well, Friendly Fire. There you have it. So those are John's four podcasts, everyone. That makes him a true professional. And you can follow them on Facebook, which is where they do their Friendly Fire stuff, hashtag Friendly Fire. Or you can follow them individually. Adam is at Cut4Time, C-U-T-F-O-R-T-I-M-E. Roderick is at John Roderick. That's a power move. And then Ben Harrison is at Benjamin R., and that is B-E-N-J-A-M-I-N-A-H-R, everyone. I'm going to have to ask him what the hell that's all about. Surely that's not a pirate reference. If so, then I'm never speaking to Benjamin again. All right. Thanks, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that discussion on The Great Escape. And I'll talk to you next time. Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.